Welcome to Film Fight Club. I'm Glenn Falcons, live with Falcon Screen, and we're joined by Chris Evans.
Hello.
And we have a special guest with us tonight, 2SER film critic and critic for the Friday Daily. Kevin Suarez is here with us. Kevin, thank you so much for coming on Film Fight Club.
You're very welcome, Glenn.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. So we have a big show. We are talking about In This Corner of the World, which screened at the Japanese Film Festival and has a general release from tomorrow. We are talking about, because we love film and we love being meta, we love films that are meta, so we're talking about films about filmmaking in the spirit of our film of the week, which is, drumroll, opening in cinemas tomorrow. There you can see it, or could have seen it from the past week, at the Hayden and the Orpheum Cremorne, The Disaster Artist. Now, this, for those who haven't heard about this film, you will be hearing about it, because this is a film about the worst film ever made, The Room, which was made in 2002 for a reported $6 million and reportedly grossed about $1,800. So didn't exactly recoup its loss right away, but did make a huge profit in years to come, because people have come to see this at midnight screenings all over the world. And you can see it at the Hayden and Orpheum once a month. I go once a year, and it is very, very fun indeed.
It's essentially this generation's Rocky Horror Picture Show. It's a raucous, drunken audience participation riot, as I understand it.
It's a good show. To my great pride and shame, I've seen it 7 times, 5 of it in the Orpheum, and yeah, it's a pretty good night. So, but this film isn't The Room. This film is The Disaster Artist. It is based on the memoir by Greg Sestero, who plays the supporting lead Mark in The Disaster Artist, and it's about the production of what many say is the worst film ever made. It is directed by and starring James Franco as the writer, director, producer, and star of The Room, the ubiquitous Tommy Wiseau. It also stars Dave Franco, James's brother, Seth Rogen, Alison Brie, and a number of others. Now, the first thing I have to say about this film is it is a film about the worst film ever made, which is trying to be the best film of the year, that's really trying to win Best Picture. And I think I might do it, because, guys, got to tell you, I've got to give this film high marks.
So do I.
Yeah. Yes, I've been waiting for that.
Mark, yeah.
Yeah, I've been waiting for that joke for a while now. It's if you haven't seen the film, there are many terrible, terrible, terrible one-liners in the film. This is but one of them. It is really worth checking out. But off The Room, what did we think of The Disaster Artist?
I really liked it. I think this film what James Franco has done in his performance is capture exactly the person that you imagine when you look at Johnny, Tommy's character, in The Room. As soon as he first appears in this film, you get the sense that he's nailed it completely. There's a shot where Greg is chasing after Tommy as he's walking away from an acting theater, and he just has this acting class. He just has this droopy eyelid, empty, sleepy look on his face, and I just thought, that's it. That's Tommy Wiseau.
Yeah, it's a performance that is remarkable in that it could have been an SNL-type skit where he's trying to mimic him or mock him, but it wasn't that. It was confronting, and it was also, and it confronted a lot of the difficult parts of his character, but it was also very affectionate. This was clearly about someone who admired and was fascinated by this character. He, considering the guy makes 12 films a year or something like that, he really put in the effort to really be Tommy Wiseau. This is a performance that could very well not just get a number of critics awards, but Oscar nominations too.
He's gunning for the Best Actor Oscar with this.
Which is something Tommy Wiseau probably wished he could gun for as well. But one of the best things about his performance as well was also the fact that he could also master the comedy, but not in a way that did mock Tommy Wiseau. As you said, make it like an SNL sketch, but sort of reveal the insecurities in him, revealing how he imagines himself as some kind of all-American boy, and how he's like a paragon of American values when he not so much. As well as the comedy also reveals into his psyche, as well as his own unique and sometimes distorted worldview and views of Hollywood as well. And it was quite fascinating to watch it.
Yeah, they strike an interesting balance, because I wouldn't say that there's no mockery of Tommy Wiseau here, because that's certainly an aspect of this film. And there's a lot to laugh at about Tommy Wiseau. He is a man who is overwhelmed by self-deception. And yeah, the movie makes no qualms about that.
He's a fascinating character. An interesting fact about the film, he insisted on not only appearing in it, but being in a scene with James Franco, which does appear. We'll keep it as a surprise. It is one of the highlights of the film.
It's after the credits.
But this is, yes,
I missed the credits.
Oh, you have to go back and watch it. But this is a film where it is clearly a... What's interesting about this film, while you may not have heard about The Room, is that it is one of the biggest jokes internally within Hollywood. People in Hollywood, people who love film, love to see this film because it is a disaster, but it is still endearing because as much as the disaster artists feel about people who clearly love film, love filmmaking, so is this, and even more so once you've read the book and get the background. And James Franco, who found out about this from an article that was written about The Room, is just trying to spread this message to so many people, and I think he's done a pretty good job of it.
Yeah, the movie was described, I think, several times as the Citizen Kane of bad movies, which most people do agree with because there is something so inherently watchable about The Room, yeah, that James Franco wanted to capture.
The Room is differentiated from most so bad it's good movies or junk that junk movie aficionados like to seek out because of a number of reasons. One is that it has really high production values for a film of such low quality content. And this movie goes into the pretty fascinating story of how that came to be, how someone with no talent was able to put together a production on the level of The Room. And two, because Tommy Wiseau's personality is all over this thing, and it's such an alien persona. Like, The Room isn't just bad, it's confusing how anybody could make the creative choices that went into this film. And this movie is... to a large extent, about how Tommy Wiseau is an alien, you know, how he's alienated from all the people around him and his tragedy. But it doesn't sentimentalize him too much, in my opinion. It manages to convey that he has very monstrous qualities at the same time as celebrating his ambition and his achievement in getting this film made and laughing at his eccentricities. I think it was a pretty convincing portrait that rang true to me when, as you say, this could easily have come off as an SNL type just parody of The Room and or a in-joke fest. So I was really happy with how this turned out, both in the screenplay and in Franco's performance.
I was too. And there are a number of sequences in the original Room which are, what, approximations of human behavior. It's not how people act. It's not how people talk. It's not how people interact. Yeah. And this goes into some of the, as Chris said, some of the really strange things about this production. This was
about
the first.
Wiseau.
Yeah. I mean, this was the first and perhaps the last film to be filmed simultaneously in digital and film. Yeah. And he bought the equipment, which people don't generally do in Hollywood. You hire it.
And apparently he even got rid of the digital footage that he recorded. He just went with the film. Or it could have been the other way around.
I think he used a bit of both. There was this issue with lack of lighting. One of the things, when you go to a screening, you shout things out at the screen. There's things, corresponding actions to almost every line. One is to shout focus at the various times of the film when the film is blatantly, blatantly out of focus, including the famous rooftop scene, which we'll play in a moment.
Yeah. The one area where I think this film really faltered for me was the end credits, where there's a side-by-side comparison showing how closely they've approximated the original scenes from The Room. And to me, this rubbed me the wrong way because it just seemed almost like showing off. I think the fans of The Room are going to appreciate how closely they've approximated those scenes. They'll notice those little details. But putting it at the end of the movie takes away from the feeling of the culmination of this narrative and then puts the audience into a space of sit back and look at how great we were for nailing it this much. You know, it's like we're feeling pretty good about the film and the filmmakers at this point. You know, no need to boast.
Yeah, they should have added that scene as perhaps a deleted scenes, or
put it on YouTube or something.
Bonus features
bonus
on the
feature,
DVDs.
Yeah. It takes you out of the feeling that the narrative gives you. It takes you out of the movie.
I do feel that perhaps they were trying to deliberately go for that feeling, especially at the beginning when they were doing those Q&As with Adam Scott and all of these people that are popular in the Hollywood industry now, talking about their experience in The Room, trying to go for a very different perspective on filmmaking.
Mm. But did that intro tie in well for the film for anyone? I don't think it really did.
It didn't tie in well at all, but I think it jarred quite badly, but I'm going to disagree slightly on the end, and I'm going to say why. I found, and I was really impressed with this, the film did not go overboard with really blatant references to the room. Mm. And at the same time, many people who go to see this film will not be familiar with The Room. They'll have no idea that it is based on another film. So to go in and suddenly see, oh, wait a second, there's this early 2000s film
really
that looks
exactly
just like it.
Bad. We're not exaggerating.
I should seek this out.
You're right.
Is this movie?
I suppose it makes sense from that perspective.
The one thing that really didn't get me about this film, though, I didn't mind it so much because I really love it, but it was actually the casting of Dave Franco, and I'll say why. Firstly, he doesn't look nothing like Greg Sestero. That's not an issue for me in and of itself, but they try to make it look like Greg Sestero, and it's a little more distracting for me than it was necessarily conducive to being faithful to a recreation. The other thing I had was that they're brothers, and they do really well in the sense that Tommy Wiseau and Greg Sestero had a warm relationship, but it was also a very fractious relationship at times, and
yeah,
I think they didn't get those parts as well.
I agree. I don't think they nailed that. That kind of icy... Yeah, there could have been a lot more psychological exploration of the strange dynamic between Tommy and Greg. As it is, I think the movie is going for a light comedy kind of feel, so they don't want to...
Over-dramatize it.
Dark kind of waters. But I think the essential beats of it are pretty satisfying, of the relationship. The movie really hinges on this relationship between Greg and Tommy, if we haven't made this clear.
Yeah. For me, even though I do love The Disaster Artist, I do feel my own personal opinion was at the beginning bit where it goes from the... you know, beginning to know each other in 1998 all the way up to 2002 when they started filming was a little bit unnecessary. It sort of fell under show don't tell, as in the book itself that it's based on started some, like, the narrative starts a few days before they start filming.
To be honest, I enjoyed seeing Tommy before Johnny. I loved the James Dean stuff. I wouldn't cut it.
I think that perhaps they should have used that as flashbacks. Maybe when they're, you know, arguing about something, it could be a flashback towards, you know, how their relationship was like beforehand, because it felt a bit too samey. A couple of other movies had done a similar idea where, you know, two friends, you know, meet each other in, like, college or university or something, and then they decide, hey, let's go do something together. I felt like that story had been played out a bit before.
I felt like it was heartfelt enough here, and it anchored the movie. I think if it had just begun when they were starting The Room, I think the production of it, I think to a general audience that doesn't love the awfulness of The Room already might say, why do we care?
Kevin, how do you find the book, having read it recently, how do you find the book compared to the movie?
Admittedly, only read some part of it, but I did notice that they did sort of mix some things around. So some of the things that happened shortly before filming, they would deliberately add into scenes separate of that of the movie. Certain something that would have happened in the book earlier, like a line. I noticed that there were a couple of lines in, like, the first chapter alone that ended up being used in a different context. And I'm not so sure about that. I think that they probably could have used those lines in the original context within the book. But I don't know, it sort of goes between, you know, like, you know, movie adaptions. It's a completely different argument how movies are adapted from books.
Fair enough. And I think it is a film worth seeking out, as is a book worth seeking out. I read it some time ago. The Disaster Artist is screening at the Hayden Orpheum and will be in cinemas everywhere from tomorrow. We'll be back shortly talking about films and a wonderful film from the Japanese Film Festival, which you can see shortly in cinemas everywhere. For now, we leave you with one of, if not the greatest scene from The Room. Stay tuned.
I did not hit her. It's not true. It's bullshit. I did not hit her. I did not. Oh, hi, Mark.
Oh, hey, Johnny. What's up?
I have a problem with Lisa. She said that I hit her.
What? Well, did you?
No, it's not true. Don't even ask. What's new with you?
Well, I'm just sitting up here thinking, you know. I got a question for you.
Yeah.
You think girls like to cheat like guys do?
What makes you say that?
I don't know. I'm just thinking.
I don't have to worry about that because Lisa's loyal to me.
Yeah, man, you never know.
It's bullshit. I did not.
And that was the famous, infamous scene from The Room.
Well, one of many.
One of many. And one of many films about...
What a story, Mark.
We could be here forever doing Tony Wiseau impersonations. And you can hear many more at the Hayden Orpheum monthly screenings. As you can see, The Disaster Artist, one of the many films about film, which we love very much. And we're here to talk. We love films. We love films that are meta. And there's nothing more meta than films about filmmaking. And I think I have a few favorites. I'm freaking to talk about them, but we all have one or two that we have always been very, very keen on.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's always these movies that focus on this topic, but, you know, such as The Bowfingers and Ed Wood, similar to The Disaster Artist in Idea. But one of my personal favorites, it's even more ridiculous than The Disaster Artist or Ed Wood. It's Tropic Thunder, right? And it's one of the first movies that really got me into, you know, movies as, you know, general, because it was just so ridiculous, so over the top. But you know what? I feel like it was one of the realest movies about the movie making process that was released, you know, so far. Because I know it sort of plays everything up for comedy. All of the actors have all of these overblown egos, but, and for example, as soon as that director says cut, some of the actors then start running off to the nearest pile of cocaine to bury their heads in it or something. But with all of these jokes, there's some sort of tinge of seriousness to them as well.
Tom Cruise is fairly convincing as Harvey Weinstein in this film.
You know, it's crazy. You're the second person to bring this film up with me today. And I've got to give credit to Robert Downey Jr. here. The second film where he's put on a pretty bad Australian accent. This one got slightly better. But this film is just so much fun. It has, as was alluded, Tom Cruise's best camera, one of his all-time best roles. And it's a film about filmmaking where anyone can watch it, whether you are a filmmaker or someone who's just, you know, whatever, yeah, and love it. And yeah, it's hilarious. And it holds up really well.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, there is all these, like, nods and winks towards people who also love movies. For example, that, you know, pyromaniac that Danny McBride plays when he accidentally blows up a part of a forest, that's actually tinged in reality as well. As much as we all laugh at it, that actually did happen with Apocalypse Now. And that got the movie makers of Apocalypse Now into trouble as well, because they accidentally did set off too many pyrotechnics in a very dense, remote forest, which they weren't happy about. So, yeah, like, there are many of these different scenes that we all laugh at, but then there is some sort of reason why it happened, you know, why they decided to include it in the movie as well.
Wow.
My problem with a lot of films on filmmaking is that I think it's an easy pathway to self-indulgence. And I find a lot of this stuff seems to be not relatable. You know, celebrities griping about celebrity problems, making movies about my struggle. However, my favorite film about filmmaking is the one that epitomizes this trend, which is 8.5, where Fellini's mastery is so great that even though it ticks all the boxes I've just listed, it's a beautifully put together dreamscape.
It is. It's an obsessive film about filmmaking. It's about dreams as much as anything else. We're going to talk about a film that is about dreams in a moment. But this is a film where I saw Birdman a few years ago, and I'm sitting there watching this one Best Picture. It's a film about theater, but it's also very much about filmmaking. And I'm watching this and thinking, how much does this mirror 8.5? How many films, how many filmmakers, including Woody Allen, have been not only inspired, but have taken directly from films like this to create amazing new features? And I think it really started off with 8.5. We really have to bring it back to the master Fellini.
Eight and a half is incredible. Woody Allen, as Glenn just referenced, did a take on 8.5 called Stardust Memories, where, you know, Woody Allen is already super self-indulgent and neurotic. How can we talk about Woody Allen without using that word? But to do Woody Allen making a take on Fellini's possibly most self-obsessed and neurotic film just tipped the scales over too much. I found this movie just absolutely insufferable. Like, it just a self-indulgence and that was so palpable that I felt like the movie wasn't letting me in to enjoy it on any level.
Yeah, I haven't enjoyed too many of his latest. Wonder Wheel is in cinemas shortly too.
Yeah, and
we're all looking forward to that.
Yeah, not really.
Sarcasm.
I think too many people have been telling him he's great without actually giving him, you know, actual criticism. And yeah, Wonder Wheel wasn't that awesome either.
Oh, too bad.
Yeah. I like films on filmmaking in general. Apart from 8.5, I like the ones that tend to use this concept to take us in a more fantastical direction.
Yes. Two of my classic, very special films to my heart are about filming. They came out at the same time, Sunset Boulevard and Singing in the Rain. And I think these two films epitomize the very different directions you can go in. The one, The Singing in the Rain, in the Hail Caesar mold, where it's very much about the fun, the history. Look at how films were made back in the
romanticization of filmmaking.
Versus Sunset Boulevard, where it's very much the dark history. Look what happened in the time of Erich von Stroheim and all these great actors, and what was actually going on when we don't know too much about film history, and how realistic a depiction is this of early Hollywood.
The darkness behind the glitz and glamour of fame. Sunset Boulevard is a big influence on film Fight Club favorite David Lynch.
It would not be film Fight Club without referencing either David Lynch or Terrence Malick. So yes, we have our David Lynch reference for the week. Thank you, Chris.
Yes, Malick.
Lynch. It's pretty interesting how these two films comparatively ended up permeating the pop culture, right?
Sunset Boulevard
and Singing in the Rain. Like, when we hear Singing in the Rain, that image is of that musical scene where they're going, I'm singing. I'm not a very good singer, so I'm not going to sing the whole thing. But that's something that a lot of people think of. But when you think of Sunset Boulevard, there's no real point of reference. I suppose a lot of people sort of think that Singing in the Rain sort of epitomizes that sort of happiness.
I think I'm Ready for My Close-Up is pretty well remembered.
I think so too. It's one of the most famous, amazing lines. It is played endless throughout every film class, through every greatest hits moment in cinema. And her comeback, Gloria Swanson, and to see how dark that film and the script actually is, because the film they show of Norma Desmond was actually Gloria Swanson's last film in the pre-talkies era before she stopped making films. She was directed by Erich von Stroheim, who played the butler in the film. There's a lot of amazing elements to this film. They bring up Buster Keaton for The Card Game, all these great old actors. It's a very eerie film noir-esque movie. I love it.
Its influence in depicting the darkness behind the Hollywood myth can be seen in Mulholland Drive. And also, David Lynch's Inland Empire. I prefer films about filmmaking like that because I find when it's all just about celebrating everything that's great about a movie, as I was saying before, it tends to tip into self-indulgence. A movie that I really could not stand on this note was The Artist, which did a really poor impression in my mind of Singing in the Rain. Yeah, what did you guys think of it?
Oh, The Artist. I enjoyed The Artist. I felt at the time, though, it didn't have the staying power many people thought it would have. I prefer Hugo. That also came out this year. Yep. A much better ode to filmmaking.
Hugo, that was a movie that never seemed to get off the ground for me until it abandoned its perfunctory kind of kids movie adventure plot and became just a full-on ode to the silent filmmaking era, and it was great.
It was, and the last film I have to bring up in this segment was the non-Best Picture winner for this year, La La Land, which is very nostalgic, which everyone loves, which is very much about a modern drive
kind
to
of
create cinema.
A similar story, like a flip side to The Disaster Artist, you know, people who believe in each other and push each other on, but with very different destinations over these two films.
Yeah, and La La Land, I did enjoy that movie, although it did feel, ironically enough, it did seem fairly similar to another Woody Allen film that came out last year as well. Like, the plotline was very similar, you know, like some of the plot beats were the same. For example, a guy brings a girl to a movie, they go on a date, and then they end up finding different people and then splitting up eventually at the end. I thought it was, again, a story that had already been done, even though I did like the style that went into it.
Yeah, you're referring to Cafe Society, the remake of Adventureland, I understand.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah, so that was films about filmmaking. I'm sure we will talk about many more in the lead up to the Oscars race in the coming months. The last one we are talking about is In This Corner of the World, which screened at the Japanese Film Festival and is in limited release from tomorrow. It is directed and written by Sunio Katabushi, and it is a cartoon. It's a beautiful film about a young woman in Hiroshima in the early 1940s. Kevin, what did we think of In This Corner of the World?
I feel like using the word cartoon may be sort of like, yeah, not
people
really
the wrong impression.
Excuse me, I should say animation. Excuse me.
It's okay. Like, but that's the thing with animated films. A lot of people sort of may, well, some people, the general public, may get the impression that a cartoon or animation is supposed to be for a younger audience. But in this case, it definitely proves that that animation can go towards an older audience.
It's
as
fairly
well.
Confronting in its latter half. So don't take the kids unless you're prepared to show them a harrowing depiction of the effects of war, I suppose.
It is honestly one of the last movie that I animated movie that I cried at was probably Up about six right. years ago, and this one at the end I was just so shocked because we barely ever see what Japanese life was like in World War II. We always see what the Americans were up to or the Nazis were up to and like Indiana Jones or similar movies what you know Hitler was doing, but we never really see what happened in Japan, and I thought it was a very interesting take on that. And especially towards the second half of the film, where the first half is life in just general life in Japan in the 30s, but then juxtaposing that life with wartime.
Yeah.
So like people living fairly, you know, straightforward, ordinary lives, and then seeing
essentially a movie about domestic chores and being a housewife for
exactly.
the first hour.
A slice of life, and it is beautiful.
Yeah.
My favorite part of this film, though, and my favorite part of the animation was we talked about Loving Vincent a few weeks ago and how they used paint to implicate ideas of emotion and life. And the character in this film is a daydreamer, as is repeatedly stated, and she uses her artistry to create different ideas of what Japan and her hometown look like, not just in currently, but in the past. And those, for me, were some of the really emotive moments. Yeah. They're a little sparing, but they were very powerful.
It goes in a kind of meta direction when it talks about it, or it depicts visually how we can use art to bring back memories of what's been lost, which is essentially what this film is. It's a very well-researched depiction of Hiroshima. The director spent 6 years going through writings and photos and talking to people who remembered Hiroshima in order to build this depiction, and it really pays off. The city is completely believable and beautifully rendered.
And yeah, and it gets really heartbreaking. One of the first heartbreaking moments was you spend an hour and a half following this main character who loves drawings and giving her drawings to her friends and family. And then halfway, like about 75% into the movie, then this officer comes in and takes away her notebook. And then it seems like a very small act, but you just sort of feel
that loss of power in
that
retrospect.
That loss of innocence and now, like, you don't know what's going to happen next.
Mm. It's a devastating moment, but it's still very understated how they play it. There aren't those many aha moments in the film or that have those dramatic flourishes with ascending crescendos of music. It is really just, by the time these events happen, you feel the impact by virtue of having to know these characters, but also by the lack thereof of the crushing moments or crushing, you know, effects that you would typically expect in a film like this.
The sound design.
Sound design is incredible.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Especially if you... I recommend catching this in the cinema just to hear the sound design, because the differentiation between this, the quiet, gentle rhythms of life and, you know, the sounds of sandals clipping on roads and water being wrung out of clothes being contrasted with the roaring sound of the firebombings and the way that the Hiroshima blast itself is depicted is really striking as well.
Film. Like it's not going for a big Hollywood moment, but fairly
very understated.
Yeah,
keeping with the aesthetic aims of this film.
Yeah.
I was curious how little they showed of that particular segment of history in the film compared to... I understand why they spent so much time on the lead up to these events, and anyone who would go into this film would know what this film is leading to, but their depictions were very sparing, which was a bit of a surprise for me.
But it is there just to give the film a sense of portent and dread, I think, because we know that's coming. The movie has this almost a countdown on screen because it's constantly giving us more and more specific dates as we get closer to August 1945. My big problem with this film, as much as we, by the sounds of it, all loved the way that the effects of the war were depicted in the second half of the film, is that I didn't really start to get into this until about an hour in, when the romance story starts to develop more, and then shortly after that, the war starts to come closer to home. The first hour of the film, which depicts the domestic life, seemed it's going for a slice of life, getting to know the characters, getting to feel the rhythm of life kind of feeling, but it's way too choppily edited and way too fast paced, so I felt like I couldn't really get into these moments or get to know these characters very well, and it weakened the power of the film. Fortunately, it recovers later on.
I think it does too. In This Corner of the World is in cinemas in limited release from tomorrow. There are a few things happening in and around town. There's a special screening of The Florida Project happening at Dendy Newtown on Sunday night. It's an advanced screening. The Paul Thomas Anderson Festival at the Round of Grits has one last screening. Is that right, Chris?
Yep, There Will Be Blood this Sunday and Monday.
My favorite of his. Star Wars Midnight Screenings happening next Wednesday night, Thursday morning around the country. I've got my tickets. Make sure you get yours. Pretty excited.
I got my lightsabers too.
I'm pretty keen.
I'm going to come as Tommy Wiseau and throw spoons.
I think he's in the wrong movie. And the last thing is tomorrow night, Moonlight Cinema is opening with, I think it might be the Australian premiere of Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri. It's definitely worth checking out. So please do get your Star Wars tickets because, oh, The Last Jedi, I have the billboards right outside
the
studio.
Good word about it.
We are. So Kevin Suarez, thank you so much for joining us. You can hear Kevin on Fridays in The Daily. It's been absolutely great having you on.
You're welcome, Glenn.
And we will be back next week with a Boxing Day special talking about some of the films.